So good morning, everyone. Nice to see you again today. So we will continue where we left off yesterday. And the next sutta on the list here is called the Shorter Discourse on the Simile of the Elephant's Footprint. Another one of my favorite suttas. I think almost every sutta is a favorite in one way or another, so it's hard to find one which is not really nice. But anyway, this is certainly a very good one. This sutta here was, among others, it was the first sutta to be taught in Sri Lanka. When Buddhism went to Sri Lanka at the time of the Emperor Ashoka, he sent his son and daughter to help establish Buddhism in Sri Lanka. This was the very first sutta that was taught in Sri Lanka. So this is quite in itself quite auspicious. So obviously they would want to teach a powerful sutta, right, to get things established over there. So this is just an extract. And what happens here before this extract is that there is a wanderer called Pilotika, and he meets a Brahmin, Janusoni. And Pilotika, he has just seen the Buddha. And on the way back from seeing the Buddha, he meets this Brahmin called Janusoni. And Janusoni asks him, you know, where are you coming from? I'm coming from seeing the Buddha. And Janusoni asked him, well, what do you think about this Buddha? Is he inspiring? Is he wise? And all these things. And this Pilotika praises the Buddha to the skies. Very kind of high praise. Part of that praising, he gives a simile of an elephant's footprint. He says that all these people, they go to the Buddha, they want to argue with the Buddha, they want to convert the Buddha to their way of looking at things, but actually what happens instead is that they get converted by the Buddha, and then they become his disciples. That's what he says. And this is like, for Pilotika, this is the elephant's footprint. You can see, that you can see that it's in the same way that you can see from a big footprint that this must be a big elephant. In the same way, you can see from the way the Buddha converts these people who come to argue with him, you can see that he must be fully awakened or fully enlightened. But of course, that's not really good enough, is it, when you think about it? Just because you can convert people and you can argue in a good way, that's not really enough to be considered awakened, right? There must be something more to this. So the story then continues, and then because this Brahmin Janusoni obviously gets very inspired, he then decides to go to the Buddha and find out for himself. And this is how it goes. Then the Brahmin Janusoni went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and related to the Blessed One his entire conversation with the wanderer Pilotika. Thereupon the Blessed One told him, "At this point, Brahmin, the simile of the elephant's footprint has not yet been completed in detail. As to how it is completed in detail, listen and attend carefully to what I shall say." "Yes, sir," the Brahmin Janusoni replied, and the Blessed One said this: "Brahmin, suppose an elephant woodsman were to enter an elephant wood and were to see in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across. A wise elephant woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are small she-elephants that leave a big footprint, and this might be one of their footprints. He follows it and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent, broad across, and some scrapings high up. A wise elephant woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are tall she-elephants that have prominent teeth and leave a big footprint, and this might be one of their footprints. He follows it further and sees in the elephant's wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, and some scrapings high up, and marks made by tusks. wise elephant's woodsmen who had not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. Why is that? In an elephant wood, there are tall she-elephants that have tusks and leave a big footprint, and this might be one of their footprints. He follows it further and sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, some scrapings high up and marks made by tusks and broken off branches. And he sees that bull elephant at the root of a tree or in the open, walking about, sitting or lying down. He comes to the conclusion, this is that big bull elephant. So this is another one of the nice similes you find in the suttas. It's a bit repetitive because remember this is originally oral literature, and because it's oral it tends to be very repetitive to enable the retention of these things in mind, right? But still, I find this simile is often very powerful. It's a very simple simile here, but it conveys a lot of meaning here. And part of the meaning here is that when you, first of all, when you think you have seen something, you don't come to the conclusion straight away, this is B, just because you have some kind of information about it, right? What you do, you continue collecting information about this phenomena or this thing that you think you have seen. So you go through all this sequence, collecting more and more information. And as you collect more information, your confidence that this is a big bull elephant, it increases, right? Because you see all the characteristics of a big bull elephant, the large footprint, the scrapings of the tusks, the broken off branches, etc. So your confidence increases, but it's only when you see the big bull elephant with your own eyes, when you actually have direct information about what is going on, it's only then that you come to this conclusion, this is indeed a big bull elephant. And it's exactly the same thing with the Dhamma. With the Dhamma, of course, you know, we start off with a little bit of confidence that this teaching is worthwhile following, is worthwhile practicing. And as you practice it, you see more and more signs that this indeed is something powerful, something worthwhile. But you don't come to any conclusion. You don't have any final knowledge about whether the Buddha was awakened, about whether there is such a thing as rebirth, and all these things, until you see it for yourself. That's when you know, right? And this is like the Buddhist way of knowing things, the Buddhist way of understanding. Knowledge is through direct experience that you have yourself, just as seeing the large bull elephant in the wood. That's important to keep that in mind. That is what true knowledge is. So this whole discourse then is about how to acquire that true knowledge, how to find out whether the Buddha was truly awakened or not. That is through following the practice outlined in this discourse. And then, when you reach the conclusion of this practice, then you know for yourself, not before that. Okay. So, that then sets up the simile. And again, similes in the suttas are often so powerful. There's so many beautiful similes. We saw the simile of the refinement of gold yesterday, and here the simile of the elephant's footprint. And there are so many of these similes in the suttas, often very simple, straight to the point. This is reason enough, in my opinion, to read the suttas, just to read all the wonderful similes in there. It really goes to the heart, right, when you get a nice simile, something that speaks to you very directly, very simply, very immediately, and it makes the point in a very nice way. It isn't as theoretical as some of the other aspects of the Dhamma. It's very kind of tangible and immediate. So that, in my opinion, is enough reason in its own right just to read the suttas. So then we come to the other side, the practical application of the simile, how it actually works in real life. So the Buddha then says, so too, Brahmin, here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully awakened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of the world, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its gods and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. So, this is the start of the gradual training here. And the gradual training, which is very interesting here, it always starts with the appearance of an awakened person in the world. The appearance of the Tathagata. That's how it always begins. It doesn't begin with you start to be virtuous and kind. It doesn't begin with anything. It always begins with a Tathagata arising in the world. That's already quite interesting, isn't it? How come the gradual training begins like that? And the reason is because the idea of awakening is actually awakening to the truth, right? It's awakening to the way things actually are, the way the world functions, whether there is rebirth, whether there is not rebirth, whether there is karma, in other words, whether there is consequences of your actions or not, whether it is possible to eliminate all suffering and all these things. This is what you awaken to. Without somebody who actually sees these things, it's like we're wandering around in the dark. When somebody penetrates that, or somebody sees that, it's as if right view, right understanding of the world arises in the world. Suddenly, it is possible to see things in the right way because somebody has seen the world as it actually is. So this is an indispensable precondition for the practice of the path to be possible. If nobody has seen the way things actually are, we are just blind. We are kind of wandering around in darkness. We cannot see things properly. If somebody penetrates this and then we have confidence in their understanding, then we have like a guide, we have a light that we also can follow. So this is the idea of a Buddha, or a Tathagata it's called here. Tathagata is just another word for the Buddha. A Buddha appearing in the world. So right view arises. So what does it mean a Tathagata appears in the world? It sounds a bit mystical, appearing in the world, we know, in some kind of mystical way. But it's not mystical. All it means is that somebody is able to penetrate and able to see things as they actually are. That's all it means. And it could be anybody, right? This is not a god. This is not some kind of special being. Obviously, there is something special about somebody who is able to penetrate in this way. But it's just an ordinary human being who happens to have the right conditioning, the right qualities at that time. Because of those qualities, they're able to penetrate and see things as they actually are. So the Buddha is an ordinary person who then, through the right conditioning, is able to penetrate to the truth. And it could be anybody. And of course, one of the great things, to my mind, about the Buddha's teachings is that these people, they arise at certain intervals, not maybe certain intervals is the wrong way, but at irregular intervals, there will be somebody here who happens to have the right qualities, that they're able to penetrate and see the truth as it actually is. There isn't like one savior, right? One person in history who penetrates to the truth. The idea of the truth can be penetrated at any time by anybody. So at irregular intervals, somebody will then have the right qualities, and this will happen. So there have been Buddhas in the past. There will be Buddhas in the future. This is not some kind of special time. And we are special people because we have been born at the time of the Buddha. No, this is just an ordinary time as they have been in the past and the future. And to me, that is a very powerful thing already, because this idea that there should be a special savior, or call it what you like, who happens to have arisen just when we are alive, to me, it's a little bit kind of self-centered, isn't it? It's like we are very important or something like that. Actually, we're not all that important at all. We're neither important or unimportant. We're just beings. We fare around in the samsara, and then one day we come across a teaching which helps us lead a better life and attain some sort of happiness and freedom from suffering. And that is the teaching of the Tathagata. So, the Buddha then is also called the eye of the world sometimes, because he sees things that we don't see here. And that's why, this arising of right view in the world. And then the other aspect here is that the other thing I wanted to show as we go through the gradual training, I think I mentioned to you yesterday that the gradual training is really just an expanded version of the Eightfold Path. So here you see the arising of right view, right? Right view is the first factor of the Eightfold Path. And this is what you're seeing here as well. Right view coming into existence, arising. Then the Eightfold Path becomes possible. Remember, the Eightfold Path is also a conditioned sequence. It starts off with right view, and right view is necessary for the Eightfold Path to become possible. Okay, so the Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, it says here. I prefer fully awakened. Quite literally, the word Buddha means awake or awakened. And the idea is that you see something, you awake to the truth, right? You see reality. To me, that is more meaningful than enlightened, which is a bit kind of vague to my mind anyway here. Perfect in true knowledge and conduct. Knowledge is vijja, conduct is charana. The idea that somebody, when you have a certain deep knowledge and understanding of things, it also affects your conduct, right? You don't just have a profound knowledge and your conduct is the same as before. If you have a profound knowledge, it affects your conduct. You become a different person. And this is one reason why you can tell when you look at somebody, you should be able to tell from the external conduct whether they are somebody who is spiritually advanced or not. This is how we can tell whether there's a Buddha in the world. You look at the Buddha and you see, well, you know, does he have the characteristics of a Buddha? Is he peaceful? Is he kind? Is he gentle? Is he compassionate? Does he have any anger or ill will? Does he have any desire? Does he have any delusion? All these kind of things. And by looking at these things, the conduct has to be fit with the vision or understanding that the person has. So conduct and knowledge always go together. If you do all kind of crazy things, it means you haven't really got that deep understanding. So that is one of the ways you look at somebody and you look, well, is this person worthy of my confidence? And if they are special, if the conduct is different, then yes, perhaps they are. Sublime, knower of the world. This knower of the world, the idea is that you have seen the world for what it is. I think knower of the world, singular, is probably better. Loka vidu in Pali. And the idea that you have seen the world. You have seen it in all its variety, in all its dimensions, all different types of rebirth. And I think also implied here is the idea of karma. Karma is the mechanism which drives rebirth, right? So you understand karma, you understand rebirth. And this is very important because by understanding this, you can see the limitations of being a human being, right? You understand the potentials of happiness and suffering in different realms. You understand what you can do and what you can't do. And you understand the limitations of existence in samsara. So that's why this is so important, the idea of loka vidu, knowing the world, knowing it to its full extent, knowing suffering, knowing happiness, and then also knowing the escape as well. Incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati. And persons to be tamed should really, in my opinion, be translated as not persons to be tamed, but tameable persons. And the idea there is that there are certain people who cannot be tamed, so to speak. Tamed here basically means that you practice the path, and by practicing the path, you give rise to all these good qualities, and all the defilements get tamed, right? The mind becomes peaceful. The tamed person is somebody who is not driven by craving, not driven by desire, but the mind is at peace, so you have a peaceful person. That's a tamed kind of person. But certain people cannot be tamed. It is like if you have a very strong view, which is contrary to Buddhism. For example, if you believe in a creator God very strongly, it's very hard to dissuade somebody from that position, that understanding. So there are only certain beings, often a very small number, who have the potential of practicing the Buddhist path in such a way that they can give up craving and tame themselves, become peaceful. So persons to be tamed. And this is one of the reasons as well that, you know, I mean, I've seen that in myself, especially in my younger days as a monastic. You know, when you find something you think is wonderful, you want to teach other people. You want to tell your family members. You want to tell everybody, this is the way, this is it. But then often that just leads to frustration, right? They don't really want to be converted by you anyway. That's just the way it is. And sometimes they haven't even got the requisites or the required characteristics, mental characteristics, to be able to understand it anyway. So you may try as hard as you might. You may keep on going, you know, trying to tell them this is the truth, this is the right way. But because they haven't got the character traits to be able to grasp it, you're wasting your time. So this is the idea of being able to understand the difference between somebody who is tameable and somebody who is not. And then to let go if somebody cannot be tamed. This ability to distinguish and the ability to let go when the time, when it is required to let go. So, he is tameable, he is teacher of gods and humans. So even if you have this nice rebirth in your next life, you get reborn in a very pleasant, godly, gods here means devas. Devas, gods in Buddhism, are just beings just like us. They're no different from us, except that they're more happy, and they have longer life, etc., etc. So you don't have to be too concerned about becoming a god in your next life, because the Dhamma might still be there, and you can still practice it. Enlightened, awakened, and blessed. So that little paragraph there, this is the standard paragraph we often chant in Buddhism. We chant the iti piso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vijja charana sampanno. This is the homage to the Buddha, and these are the qualities that are mentioned here. So it's good to reflect a little bit on this. If you can reflect on these qualities and you can understand them, and you can find inspiration in these qualities, what happens is that you can get a sense of joy in just thinking about the Buddha, reflecting about the Buddha. This is called the Buddha Nusati, recollection of the Buddha. And this ability to gain joy in meditation, as I was mentioning yesterday, is so important for meditation to take off. So if you can think about the Buddha, these qualities, and you can get a sense of joy that, wow, this amazing person arisen in the world is my teacher. He's there teaching me. What a wonderful thing that is. And you can feel inspired and happy because of that. Get a sense of joy. Then you are on the right track. This is the purpose of this recollection. The purpose is not just to chant it like a parrot, you know. This is what many, many people do. That's not the point. The point is to understand what it means. To allow it to penetrate into your heart, to make it a power of happiness and joy, then you are using this kind of reflection in a good way. And I often myself, sometimes I like to think about the Buddha. When I think about the Buddha, I think of two things in particular. I think about the wisdom aspect of the Buddha. And the wisdom aspect means that the Buddha is someone who understands happiness and suffering to the full extent, right? Absolutely full extent of happiness and suffering. And because I know for myself that I'd rather be happy than suffer in life, and my experience is that that's true for everybody pretty much. Everybody wants to be happy rather than suffer. Well, here is a teacher who can tell you everything there is about happiness and suffering. That is what is meant by wisdom in Buddhism. That's very powerful, isn't it? Your very kind of core desire, the very kind of most fundamental thing of what it means to exist, to be a being, to be human. This desire for always getting what is good, what is nice, getting away from pain and suffering. Here is someone who has the full answer to that. Isn't that a powerful thing? To me, it's such a very, very powerful thing. And when you think about that, wow, it really kind of stirs you. There's something very, very important here, very powerful here. And not just does he have the wisdom, but the Buddha also has the compassion, right? Remember, at the point of a Buddha, as soon as the Buddha has attained awakening, he doesn't really have any purpose in the world anymore. For him, his existence has come to completion. He has seen all there really is to see for himself. So for himself, there is no real purpose in life anymore. The only purpose of a Buddha is to teach others. His only purpose is compassion. Nothing else apart from compassion. So everything he says is therefore based on compassion. Everything he does is based on compassion, because for him there is nothing else. So that is a very powerful combination. He's acting out of compassion, and he has the highest possible wisdom. Those two things combined means that there's something very powerful about these teachings. So that is how one of the ways that I like to reflect. You have to find your own way, whatever works for you. But this is the purpose of this particular paragraph here. Reflecting on the Buddha, understanding what a Buddha actually is. Okay. He declares, and then you have this whole sentence here about the gods with the Maras and Brahmas, etc. He declares all these things through direct knowledge. And again, this is about just the understanding of the world, right? He has a complete understanding of the world, of the possibilities in this world for any being, any human. That's really all it means. And he has understood this by direct knowledge. It's not a teaching that has been handed down in scriptures. It's not something that has been told by other people. This is immediate knowledge, and that's why it is reliable. He teaches the Dhamma good in the middle, good in the beginning, good in the end. So when you practice this Dhamma, it is always going to be a blessing for you, regardless. With the right meaning and right phrasing, so even the phrasing is very careful in the Dhamma. The meaning, of course, is very important, but even the phrasing is very... He cares for the phrasing to a great extent. And that is why the word of the Buddha often is special. It is very concise, very to the point. He doesn't kind of mess around. He doesn't, you know, it's very straightforward and to the point. So that's one of the great reasons why it is so useful to read these suttas, precisely because they have these qualities. And he reveals a holy life, the brahmacharya, that is utterly perfect and pure. And this refers mostly to the monastic life. Of course, the monastic life when it is well lived. And it refers also to a lesser extent to a lay Buddhist when they practice. But the revealing of the utterly perfect life usually refers to the monastic life. Okay, so there you are. It's very... paragraph full of meaning there. I can't really go into more details, I think, otherwise we're going to be here for the rest of the retreat just looking at this paragraph. So we'll move on to the next one there. A householder or householder's son or one born in some other clan hears that Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. Possessing that faith, he considers thus, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune, abandoning a small or a large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. So this is the person, he hears the Dhamma. So this householder or householder's son, all of this just means anyone, right? And women are certainly not excluded. Just because it says son, this is just the kind of the way the suttas tend to be centered on the male gender. It doesn't mean that anyone is excluded for that reason. But you hear that Dhamma, and when you hear that, you acquire faith in the Buddha, the Tathagata. And this is, again, one of the important things here. This is when you meet a Tathagata, a Buddha, first of all, there's something very powerful about the teachings. But there's also something powerful about the person, right? When you see somebody like that, it's somebody who's very different from what you're used to seeing. Somebody who's very peaceful, very at ease, very compassionate, very kind, very detached at the same time. There's something very powerful about a person like that. And it says in the sutta that even just seeing an arahant, even just seeing somebody who is fully awakened, is a great blessing in the world. So just seeing somebody who is spiritually advanced, wow, you think, gee, you know, I could do with some of those qualities. That would be really nice to have some of those, that kindness and freedom from anger, whatever. Wow. So, and then you gain faith because you see the qualities together with the power of the teaching that he gives. There's a congruence. There is a match between the teaching and the personality and the person. And that's how confidence arises. I'm not sure if faith is such a good word, because for me, faith is like a word used often in theistic religions where you have faith in something you cannot really know anything about. And often it's very strong. You say, this is the way it is, without having any, you take it on board. It's more like confidence in the sense that it's based on a certain observation. It's not blind, right? And this is the point here. So you gain that confidence in the Tathagata. And remember, the way it is phrased here, it looks like you just go up to the Buddha and you gain confidence straight away. Of course, it isn't really like that. This often takes time, right? You come to the Dhamma, you meet certain people that initially may inspire you a little bit. But then over time, as you hear the teachings, as things mature, confidence either increases or it might decrease. You just don't know what might happen. So you keep on doing these things, and if it is right for you, the confidence will increase. If it isn't, it might decrease. But the point is, it often takes time for this confidence to be really strong and firm. And sometimes the confidence will decrease. For example, if you have come to the Dhamma for the wrong reasons, or you have not really understood the message properly, you think it says something, you think that there is a creator God in the Dhamma somehow, but actually when you find out that actually there is no creator God there, then you lose all confidence and you walk away, because you need a creator God for your type of personality here. Anyway, so possessing that faith, he considers thus, household life is crowded and dusty. So crowded, in those days people tended to have lots of children, right? There wasn't any birth control, anything like that, so there was many, many children often. And perhaps sometimes the houses were quite small. They had maybe one or two rooms. So it literally was much more crowded in those days than it probably is now. Dusty here is a metaphor. Dusty means it is like there is defilements involved with it. Dust in Pali often is a metaphor for defilement or for delusion. We talk about people having little dust in their eyes. It means little delusion, basically, in the mind, is what it means. So household life, because you have lots of family members, because you have a husband or wife, because you have possessions around you, there is more attachment, normally, in the household life. This is not absolute. I'm not saying that this is always the case, but on average, there is more attachment in the household life than there is in a life gone forth, right? At least when the life gone forth is lived well. Often it is not lived well, in which case it may not make much difference. But if it is lived well, there is less attachment there. So there's less dust, there's less delusion, and there is less clarity about what you're doing here. Remember that when I make this distinction between monastic life and lay life, these are not absolute distinctions, right? Sometimes a lay life, which is lived really well, is much better than a monastic life, which is lived poorly. But the point is that if monastic life is lived to its very best, then that is the best vehicle for making progress in the Dhamma. And that is what this means. And that is, of course, why it was laid down by the Buddha. It doesn't mean that you cannot make progress in lay life. You certainly can. It just means that this is the kind of the best vehicle. So, you think, you consider life, household life, as crowded and dusty, and life gone forth is wide open. In other words, it is the opposite of crowded and dusty. And then he recognizes that it's not easy to live the holy life, the brahmacharya, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell while living in a home life. So then he thinks, well, maybe I should shave off my hair and beard. put on the yellow robe, should probably be the ochre robe, like brownish yellow, and then go forth from home life into homelessness. And then he decides that he will do this, and then he abandons on a later occasion the small and large fortune. In other words, you give up your possessions. That is the ideal in the when you go forth. And you abandon a small or large circle of relatives. This is also part of going forth. You shave off your hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and then you go forth from the home life into homelessness. So that is the ideal of the gradual training, is actually going forth from the home life into homelessness. And the reason this is stated here at the beginning is because the gradual training takes you all the way to full awakening. A full awakening can only really be achieved by going forth, by becoming a monk or a nun in this way here. It doesn't mean that the gradual training is not applicable to lay life. It is. It's just that the full benefit of the gradual training can only be achieved by going forth. This is what this means. So please don't feel excluded by this. Otherwise, it might all sound a bit too elitist, perhaps. I don't know how to put it. And again, you will notice here that, again, I want to match this up with the Noble Eightfold Path. You see at the beginning here of this paragraph, he gains confidence. That gaining of confidence is equivalent to acquiring right view, ordinary right view. You have confidence in a certain teaching. That means you have a view that accords with that teaching. So you gain right view. And then the going forth into homeless life, the thinking, the idea that I will go forth, that is right intention, right? The attention of renunciation, of giving up the household life, and also the intention which is implied by that, of being kind, of having metta, or having compassion for people around you, is also implied by that. So here you see the Noble Eightfold Path starting to take hold. The person hears the Dhamma, gets right view, and then the right intention springs from that. And then he acts on that right intention. He becomes a monk or a nun, and of course he then undertakes the conduct of a monastic, which is first of all the virtuous conduct, and that is what comes next in this gradual training. Next, now we get into the actually what you do once you have gone forth, or once you have decided to undertake this training. This is what happens next. Having thus gone forth and possessing the bhikkhu's training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings, with rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious, merciful, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Abandoning taking of what is not given, he abstains from taking what is not given. Taking only what is given, expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity. Abandoning in celibacy, he observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the common practice of sexual intercourse. So this is then the beginning of this path of gradual training. And this first part here is what is considered like right conduct, right? This is the right action. And again, it fits with the right action in the Noble Eightfold Path. And this, of course, also is very similar to what you see when you keep the eight precepts, right? When you come here and you keep the eight precepts for this retreat, this is basically what you are keeping here when you come here. And it starts off here with the abandoning of the killing of living beings, abstaining from killing of living beings. This is obviously very important, absolutely fundamental to the Buddhist path. And this is why it is part of the five precepts. As it says in the suttas, the five precepts, these are like the foundation stone for any living of the Buddhist life, right? And actually, just keeping the five precepts is a very, very powerful thing here. You should never underestimate that. It says in the suttas that there's more merit, or more kind of good karma, if you like, or more happiness, is another way of putting it, to be gained from practicing the five precepts than there is from almost any kind of donation that you can make. So these things are very powerful and very important. Of course, it doesn't mean that you kind of move away from generosity and you start keeping the precepts. You have kind of outgrown the generosity part of the path. Now I'm going to keep precepts instead. That's not what it means. It just means that now you take it all a bit further. And in fact, usually, you become even more generous when that happens. But an important aspect of this factor, as it is mentioned here, is that it's not just about the abandoning of the killing of life. You will see here, it says here that he abstains from the killing, but with rod and weapon laid aside, he is conscientious and merciful and compassionate to all living beings. So there's two aspects to this this part of right action. There's the aspect where you don't do the bad stuff, but there is the aspect where you do what is right, where you do what is good. And this is very important to remember, that the path, when lived fully, when lived properly, is not just about not doing the bad, it's actually about doing the good. And this is very important because remember that a very, very important aspect of meditation practice, of a spiritual life that actually works, is to give rise to joy, right? Give rise to this happiness inside. That joy is what drives meditation. Without that joy, meditation is never going to take off. And that joy is derived from two things. First of all, it is derived from not doing the bad things. When you don't do the bad things, it means you don't have any remorse. You don't feel bad about what you've done. You don't darken your mind through doing bad things. So that is a kind of negative happiness, right? You don't suffer because of your bad actions. That is one aspect of that happiness. But the other aspect, which is very powerful, is that from doing good, you can have a sense of joy when you look back upon your life. You know that you've been a good person. You know that you've been doing the good things. And that is often enough to give you a sense of joy. If you do that regularly, again and again over time, then the goodness of the heart is what gives you joy inside. And the goodness of the heart is just doing good things just because it feels good, right? No other reason whatsoever. And then that comes back to you in your meditation practice. And that is, of course, important both in daily life when you're not on retreat, but it's also good to do good things while you are on retreat. If you do something nice while you're here, if you have the chance to do something nice, whatever it is, even tiny little things, you will find that it can give rise to the joy that you need here and now, just to get your meditation a bit of oomph and get more, a bit more power as you do things. So whenever you see an opportunity, don't waste it, because I think the Buddha says somewhere that punya, this idea of merit, is a word, is a term for happiness. So if you do good, it's a term for happiness, basically. So this is a very important aspect of this, of virtue in Buddhism, the positive and the negative virtue. Another very interesting aspect of this first line here is that you will notice you abstain from killing living beings. But actually, it is the motivation here that is very important, right? The idea is that you abstain from living beings because you are compassionate, you are merciful. You don't just abstain for whatever reason, but because of compassion. So the idea is that this abstention happens because of compassion. There is the reverse, which is called the wrong type of action. And there it says that you kill living beings, you are merciless, and you are like bloody-handed, you don't care about living beings. In other words, the killing of living beings, the assumption there is that it comes from a hard heart, ill will, negativity, all these negative things. So this is a very important aspect of understanding what is right action and what is wrong action. In the end, right action and wrong action is about your motivation, what drives you, what actually, what causes you to do these particular things. This is very important to understand, because what that means is that the five precepts, they are like a guideline, right? But really, to know whether something is right or wrong, you have to look at what drives you in these things. What is it that causes you to do things? Are you coming from compassion? Are you coming from kindness, or are you acting from greed or negativity or ill will or whatever it might be here? That is how you know whether action in the end is right or not. And that is very useful to know, because that means that, you know, ethical, complicated things like, you know, sometimes we talk about things like euthanasia or whatever it might be, you can look at those in a new way, because you understand that really it is motivation that is what matters in Buddhism, to decide whether something is good or bad. So it gives you a lot more scope for deciding in these ethical conundrums that we sometimes are faced with as Buddhists, or anybody else for that matter. So, there you are. That is the first factor then. Again, this is like samma kamanta, right action. Don't destroy living beings, but in fact, you are compassionate and kind, and you help beings. You're kind to them whenever you have the opportunity. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, you abstain from taking what is not given. And this means that you abide in purity. So again, this is the negative aspect of morality. And the positive aspect of morality in this case is, of course, being generous, right? The opposite of taking what is not yours, which is greed, is giving up, is renouncing and giving out. So that is the opposite in this case. And generosity is one of those other things that has this incredible power to give rise to joy when it's done in the right way. When you give something for yourself, from yourself, sometimes you do something spontaneous, an act of spontaneous kindness. And often those spontaneous acts are very powerful, because you just do it because it's right. It feels good right there. And sometimes you will probably have noticed, you feel a sense of joy afterwards. Wow, that was nice. It feels good. And then that joy again is exactly the sort of thing that drives a meditation later on and takes you towards samadhi and deep stillness, etc. So again, the importance of both the positive and the negative aspect of virtue. And then lastly, we have here the celibacy. So this is concern for monastics. Celibacy here means all complete sexual abstinence. So the point here is that you want to, again, renounce, right? You're renouncing sensual desire, basically. And so and by doing that, you're changing the mind. You're trying to direct the mind in a new direction, in a direction where you find happiness somewhere else. So that is why all of these things are important to create that happiness somewhere else. It says here, it's translated the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. I think the word vulgar is not really appropriate. The Pali is gammo. Gammo means of the village. And of the village is like common, right? The common practice is really the more appropriate translation. Otherwise, it becomes it's a bit too strong, I think. It's not really what it's actually meant here. Okay, so that is right action for you on the Noble Eightfold Path. And then comes the next aspect here, which is right speech. So, abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. Abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus, he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. Abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, are lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous and desired by many, agreeable to many. Abandoning gossip or idle chatter, he abstains from idle chatter. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and the discipline. At the right time, he speaks words such as are worthy recording, reasonable, moderate and beneficial. So these are the four aspects of right speech. And again, you will notice here that there is two sides to each part here. There is the negative side, you shouldn't be doing this. And there is the positive side, what you actually should be doing. So you shouldn't lie. But again, you should actually speak the truth, things as they actually are. You should not be a deceiver of the world, however that happens. But you should be straightforward about these things. Again, I always like to make the point, remember that in all of these things, it's false speech, of course, is bad in its own right. But remember that also why you lie is also very important here. What is the motivation? What lies behind it? You can lie because of anger, you can lie because of greed, and then it is very coarse. Or you could lie because somebody, you feel that, oh, they're not ready to hear the truth, and you sort of turn the subject aside, or you try not to answer too directly. In that case, it's maybe you're coming from compassion, right? So in that case, lying may not be so bad. In fact, in certain instances, if you really are coming from compassion or wisdom, then you know, turning the subject aside, not saying things outright, may actually be the right way of doing things. So please remember this. It is why you do things are fundamental to whether something is right or wrong in Buddhism. Motivation is absolutely significant here. And then you have the next one, which is the abandoning of malicious speech. This is like the divisive speech, right, where you talk badly about somebody to somebody else. And whenever we talk badly about somebody to somebody else, we tend to divide those people apart, right? And that is why it is considered bad. Of course, what is mentioned here is a particularly coarse form of division, but any kind of division that divides people is always bad. So if you need to say something about somebody which is not so nice, then make it just short and to the point. Don't go on at great length. And then, you know, bring in the positive sides as well, if you can. So this is about creating a sense of harmony and concord. So this delighting in harmony is, again, very important. This is the opposite side of dividing people. Delighting in harmony, delighting in concord, delighting in unity. And there is a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha says specifically that if you want your meditation to succeed, you have to have harmony in the community that you're in. So if you are in a monastic community, that monastic community is only going to function properly if you have harmony within that community. If there is friction and problems, then you bring those problems back with you to your kuti, and it's much difficult for most people, unless you are very, very developed on the Buddhist path. It is very difficult to then just settle down and do the meditation. So harmony is actually fundamental for spiritual progress. So somebody who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, right? A promoter of friendships. So all of these very beautiful, beautiful words, very meaningful words. And it's good to reflect on this and actually think about what it means. Bringing people together, this is the right sort of thing here. Okay, so the third aspect of speech then is abandoning the harsh speech. So instead of harsh speech, you have speech that is gentle, pleasing to the ear, right? Pleasing to the ear. Yeah, I can't remember the Pali so. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Pleasing to the ear, lovable as goes to the heart, courteous, desired by many and agreeable to many, right? So gentle words that are kind, not words that are harsh and tough, so to speak. So this is the ideal way of speaking, generally. Again, this too actually matters quite a lot for meditation practice. It says that harsh speech is one of those things that blocks the speaker of those words from attaining deep meditation. Harsh speech is one of the problems. It goes against samadhi, specifically, it says in the suttas. So you want to say things that people like, that people want to hear, that is agreeable to them, without necessarily meaning that you are attached, or you actually want to, you know, want them to be your friend. You don't have any kind of hidden agendas, anything like that. You just do it because you know it's right and because it's beautiful. And then the last one here is you abandon gossip. But it's not actually gossip, it's actually idle chatter. Gossip to me is more like has a sense of being slightly dodgy, a bit kind of divisive. This is more like idle chatter, right? Just talking for talking's sake, so to speak. Yeah. So instead of that, you speak at the right time. You speak what is fact, what is good, on the Dhamma and discipline. You speak such words that are worth recording. This is... the Pali literally says such words that are worthy of treasuring, it says in the Pali here. And isn't that beautiful when people speak things that you are really powerful and really inspiring here? It's like reading the suttas, right? You read this and every word is like something special that you want to treasure. You want to keep it inside of yourself. You want to store it in your heart so you can bring it out at the right time, the right opportunity here. Isn't that wonderful when you hear such words? And how rare it is often in the world that we hear such words that really are worth recording and really worth treasuring here. And this is, of course, why you have a spiritual tradition like the Buddhist one to give you more access to that type of particular words. Words that are moderate. In other words, you don't just go on talking and talking too much. There's moderation in speech. You know what needs to be said. And when what has been said, then you remain quiet. So this is then the ideal way of speaking. Please, this does not mean that you can never say anything nice to people. Just say hello, how are you, you know, have a nice day and these kind of things. Of course you can say this too. This is very important. And the Buddha, specifically in the suttas, you will see that the Buddha did this himself. He starts off with an amiable and nice talk. He has a chat with whoever comes to see him. And they say some nice words to each other. This is important as well, right? Because this creates unity. This creates friendship. This creates harmony. This is not idle chatter. So it doesn't mean that you become kind of like an oyster and completely quiet. It means that you do things that are meaningful and to the point, which also includes being friendly. Okay, so that is the right speech and the right action. And I will just read out the next paragraph as well. This next paragraph is very kind of monastic related. I will read it out simply to be complete in what we're doing. But I'm not going to talk too much about it because it's not really all that relevant for ordinary life. So anyway, it goes as follows. He abstains from injuring seeds and plants. He practices eating only one meal a day. Abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time. He abstains from dancing, singing, music, and theatrical shows. He abstains from wearing garlands, smartening himself with scents, and embellishing himself with unguents. He abstains from high and large couches or beds. He abstains from accepting gold and silver. He abstains from accepting raw grain and raw meat. He abstains from accepting women and girls. He abstains from accepting men and women slaves. He abstains from accepting goat and sheep. He abstains from accepting fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, fields and lands. He abstains from going on errands and running messages. He abstains from buying and selling. He abstains from false weights, false metals and false measures. He abstains from accepting bribes, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery. He abstains from wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunder, and violence. So this is like more detail about morality on the path, and you recognize many of the things here, no doubt. The first one is abstaining from injuring seeds and plants, which is interesting because it makes you wonder why that is in there. And it seems that the reason why it is in there is because at the time of the Buddha, this was considered wrong to injure seeds and plants. Nowhere does the Buddha say that you actually make bad karma from doing this. So presumably it was just an accepted custom at that time. And if you were going to be taken seriously, you had to abide by that, presumably. Only eating in one meal of the day, that is means either that or it means eating in one period of the day, from dawn to midday. The actual rule in the vinaya of the monks specifies eating between sunrise and noon. And then you have all the things that are abstaining from the from entertainment, etc., dancing, singing, and all these things, from wearing garlands and using scents and unguents like makeup, etc. So this is just the eight precepts, right? High and large couches, still on the eight precepts. Accepting gold and silver, this includes accepting money. So here we are coming to the ten precepts, the precepts of a novice and of a fully ordained monk or nun. And then you have this idea of not accepting raw grain and raw meat. This is because you don't cook as a monastic. In fact, there is a special rule against cooking. And then you have all these other things you're not supposed to accept. And of course, all of these things that come after here, slaves and goats and sheep and elephants and lands and fields and all this, this is all a sign of wealth at the time of the Buddha. And as we saw before, you give up all your property when you take ordination, right? So all of these things then get given up as a consequence. You don't run errands and messages, and you don't buy and sell. And then you have this whole list of things that you're not supposed to do. And really, it's rather curious that this list is there. In the Chinese version, the list of this sutta, the list is not there. This is only in the Pali version. So this may be a later addition, I'm not sure, because it is rather curious. You wouldn't think monks or nuns would get into this sort of stuff. False weights, false measures, bribes, deceiving, defrauding and trickery, wounding, murdering, binding, brigandage, plunder and violence. So that sounds really over the top for a monastic. But anyway, it's there for some reason. I'm not sure exactly why it is. So, there you are. But it's time to stop on the gradual training. All of the things that I have been reading out today, these are the foundation stones of the Buddhist path. And these things are incredibly important for a success in meditation, for success in spiritual life, for attaining happiness, for avoiding suffering. These are really kind of foundational. And if you get these things right, the rest of the path tends to happen by itself. If you're able to change your attitude, change the way you are, move towards kindness, compassion, all these good things, then that is really such an important foundation stone for the whole of the spiritual path. Anyway, so thank you very much, and I will see you again at 3 p.m. Is that right? Yeah, 3 p.m. this afternoon.